Welcome to Reboot Republic, the podcast of hope, Ireland's leading politics and social change podcast that most importantly looks at the solutions and alternatives and ideas for a republic of equality. I'm Rory Hearn, your host, and joined as always by Tony Groves, my alter ego and co-host. Tony, how are you?
I'm great, Rory. The sun has shined. It's the summer solstice, I believe, as we're recording this. So, you know what, guys, let's hope we get a little bit of a summer now with the go with it.
That's it. And we are in a podcast of hope today, and we're joined, really, really delighted and privileged to be joined by Dr. Niall Muldoon, the Ombudsman for Children. Niall, thanks a million for coming in.
Thank you very much for the invitation. Delighted to be here.
Great. I was going to ask you straight out, because I was interested looking at your background. You are a counselling and clinical psychologist. How does or why does a counselling and clinical psychologist end up as the Ombudsman for Children?
Well, it's an interesting story, and I always try to lead with Chris Hadfield, the famous space commander from Canada, talked about how when he was a young person, he always wanted to go to the moon, but he had to plan his career for a job that hadn't existed at that stage, because there was no Canadian spaceman. I never planned on being an ombudsman for children, but I always loved working with children.
Yeah.
From the time I was a young person. I spent 5 years working in the Bank of Ireland when I came out of school, and decided.
Actually, children, the managers.
I realized that I loved working with people. I wasn't so good with the figures. So I redirected myself. I had to go to college. I went to college and university in London because I couldn't go to college here in Ireland, because at that stage, back in the late 80s, I had not put my best foot forward in secondary school, and I didn't do a second language. So Okay. Every single university barred me from going in. So the only way I could go to university was to go to England. And thankfully the EU paid for me in those days, because you were crossing the borders. They covered me. So I went to and did a degree in psychology there, came back to Ireland, and spent 20 years then working as a psychologist, working originally in child protection area. So I worked with disability, and I also worked with adults who sexually offended against children, and adults who suffered abuse as children. And then I moved to work with children and families who were affected by abuse. So I'd spent all this time working around the area of child protection. I was very lucky that I got a job, or there was an opportunity come up in the Ombudsman for Children's office as director of investigations. Very lucky to get selected for that. Spent 2.5 years in that role before Emily Logan, the first Ombudsman for Children, decided to move away from the role. And then I just applied. I just, like, my fingers crossed, I applied. I didn't think I was going to get it. My target was to get to the top five. Thankfully, I got to the final interviews. And at that stage, the interviews were all the way through. There was 30 children involved in the selection of the Ombudsman for Children.
Wow.
They designed the job description. They designed the advertisement. They were involved in the final selection interviews. The scariest interview I've ever done, you know, 17 children asking you what you would do in this situation,
That's
that situation.
Incredible.
So it was fantastic. I think they had about 50% of the vote as to selection, which is fantastic. A great way to lead from the front. I didn't do anything. I think the best thing I did do was that at the very end of it, it was nearly lunchtime, and they asked, "Have you anything else to say?" I had nothing left to say, and I said, "No, I have nothing else to say." And I think they were just so delighted to get out for lunch that I think that stood in my favor. But it was a really tough, because children don't lie. They spot a bluffer.
Yeah.
You can't pretend. They were talking about their own stories, so they weren't following scripts. So you had to be real and genuine. So that's all I did. Mm-hmm. I said, "Listen, you know, I don't know how to do this, so I'm just going to be who I am."
Yeah.
And thankfully it worked out. And the reason I went for the job is just, I always try to see, can I do something? Would I be good enough at this? Thankfully, they thought I would, and the interview panel thought so too. And 4.5 years later, now I think I'm still trying to get the hang of it and see, can I be good at this, and can I get better at this, and can we make a difference on a macro level?
Yeah, because you definitely have had an impact in terms of the reports that your office is producing, and I suppose just in terms of to explain people, you know, what is the role of the office, and, you know, in terms of, you just saying there, to have an impact, like maybe you could explain the role of what is the impact you want to have.
Yeah, I mean, the role of the Ombudsman for Children's Office is designed, it's an independent statutory body, which means that I don't report to the government, I don't report to a minister, and I don't report to the department. My contract is signed by the President of Ireland. So my job is essentially to be a pain in the side of the government to make sure that they do as best they can for every child in the country.
Yeah.
We promote and protect the rights of all children in Ireland, all 1.2 million children. And we do that by raising awareness of children's rights through the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child and our office, by giving advice and recommendations to the government around policies, procedures and legislation around children, anything to do with children, and also taking complaints in relation to children and any issues they have in relation to public bodies. So that could be a hospital, a school, housing authority, local authority, justice, any area that the children interact with the government, we can take complaints on. If they haven't been happy with the complaint, how it's handled locally, they give them a chance to fix it locally. If that doesn't work, they can come to us as a free and impartial alternative to court. Okay. Before we were set up, people had to sue, and that wasn't feasible for a lot of families. So that's one of the big things that we have now, is that opportunity to do that. And we get 1,700 complaints a year now because of that.
Yeah, and maybe you could kind of detail, like, what are the sort of complaints you get and what can you do about them then?
Yeah, we get a range of complaints. I mean, not all the complaints that come to us are suitable for us, so we will often signpost them to different directions. But the majority of the complaints that we get are around the education system. Probably consistently, it's been between 45 and 50% of our complaints are in that area. And that could be anything from my child's not getting access to the school teams, through to my child isn't got a special needs assistant, through school transport, through to I'd like my child to opt out of religion, and the way the curriculum has been addressed. So all those range, anything that education has to do with is we can cover. And it's, people often ask, why is education such the biggest issue? And it's mainly because children spent 8 hours a day, or, you know, between 6 and 8 hours a day in school for 14 years of their life. So it's where they interact with the state most often. The next one after that is the area of sort of family support and care, which would be sort of the TUSLA area, where children, that would relate to social workers, child protection, foster care, all those issues that children would have, maybe children leaving care. And then the next one after that would be in the area of health. So hospitals, waiting lists, perhaps access to operations. We did a big report on scoliosis and the right to access to health as a right for children at all times. It's, so those are the range of things, the sort of access. And we would deal with complaints. Out of the 1,700 complaints we get, we might only investigate maybe 10 or 12 in a year.
Okay.
Because what we do is we try, the focus is always on local resolution. So the child needs to get it done as quickly as possible and as fixed as quickly as possible, especially with an education, because it's all about relationships. And, you know, families and children want to move on with their education as quickly as possible. So we try and get fixed. And that works most of the time. But sometimes you get the more complicated, more difficult situations. We have to bring it to full investigation. And we do that oftentimes looking to see if we can change the system. So it might be one complaint might be relevant to other areas of the work, and that might mean that other children are affected. One of those examples is that a young boy came from outside of Europe, unaccompanied minor. He'd been here before, come through huge trauma, war, death, violence, all in his house. He'd been expelled from school when he was about 7 or 8 years of age, went back to his family home and came back on his own then at 12, and went into a fabulous foster family and couldn't get access to secondary school. 26 schools said no to him over a 2-year period. So he got he got home tuition, which meant that he got 9 hours a week home tuition instead of being in school 28 hours meeting friends and recovering.
Yeah.
We challenged that, and every school had the right to say no. And the Department of Education said, we'd done everything they did everything they could. They couldn't force a school, and they'd given the home tuition. So in theory, we couldn't find against them, but we felt that there was a moral obligation from the Constitution to provide education for this young man. And that wasn't sufficient, what he was getting over 2 years. So we pushed it, and we've now ended up with a change in the legislation, which is available at the moment and has come through, called in the Education Admissions Bill. The minister is now in a position where, if he needs to in those situations, the Education Welfare Officer can ask him to designate a school to take a child in that situation.
Yeah.
They similarly, in the same legislation, a special needs coordinator can ask the minister to designate a school if a child with special needs hasn't got access to it. So that's where one case changed the legislation for all children in the future. And that's the sort of stuff we look to do to make a difference.
Well, I suppose that that brings us on to like the other. You're there coordinating with other areas. So TUSLA, as you referenced, the Department of Education, no doubt. Where would you find the biggest challenge that we that you know that your office faces?
I think one of the simple, what I would think is the simplest thing, if we could get departments, all departments, to make their decisions based on the need of the child. So child-centeredness, and the second one after that, and the two of them go together, is cooperation between departments. You know, I think that's the crucial part that we're missing here. And I think it's something we can do very, I would expect, could be done better than it is being done at the moment. I think what we've done is we've set up a phenomenally positive, very good system that works. And I've always said this, works for 90% of all people. All systems work for 90% of the people. And then you need flexibility for the other 10%. And we don't have that flexibility. And if we do have it, it's not supported at the highest level. So our civil servants who want to make a certain decision for the rights of a child are afraid they'll set a precedent, or they're afraid they'll do something that won't be supported by their bosses. And what I've always said is we can work to create a type of system that protects that flexibility. So, you know what? I've always asked, have you thought of the best interest of the child? Have you made the decision in the best interest of the child? Have you written down how you made this decision? And if they can answer that, then I have a less, there's less likely I'm going to challenge them, their decision making. But what happens at the moment is they make it in the best interest of the system. You know, the child doesn't fit the system, therefore I can say no to this child for whatever it is, instead of saying, what can I do for this child?
Isn't it funny you mentioned that? And I'm sorry now, but we talked about the evil banker in the room as me. And I often think in terms of the, say central bank rules, and there are within policy, and then there's actually exceptions too. And they're generally accepted that you need, you know, over 10%, closer to 13 to 17% are exceptions that we, that things have to be done. Okay. And that is in their role as, you know, that is an acceptable divergence from policy.
Okay.
You know, and it, so that not every case is typical, I suppose, is what I'm saying. But when you come to children, putting children central, I suppose, your first point seems to me to be the key point.
Yeah, and I think it is. It's difficult because it hasn't, the system, we're 110 years of a high quality civil service working here in a certain way, and we have to adjust that. And I think it's starting to get there. We're starting to do that. I mean, this year, the Department of Education are looking at starting a review of the senior cycle for leave insert.
Yeah.
And for the first time ever, they've asked 40 different schools to talk to the children. I mean, how ironic is that? They keep talking with the education partners, and that includes the unions, the parents, the teachers, the Department of Education, and many, many other adults, but they've never asked children before. And the feedback so far has been that the most interesting and different and valuable feedback has come from the children. Because they all, and I've always said, when you ask children, they will only tell you what they need. They won't tell you for anything more. They won't look for gold plated. They look for justice and equality and fairness. And I think we have to start doing that. And that's a start of child-centeredness, if you start doing that in the Department of Education. Another example is that we had an investigation called the Molly case, which is a child with disability, severe, profound disability, who was in foster care. And the foster mother had looked after this child for 14 years since they were about 3 months old, and was worn out, and came to us and said, listen, I keep fighting with HSE and TUSLA to pay the bills and to give me support for this. And when we went to look at it, you know, this is simply, this child needs a level of support that they will always need for the future. The foster parents shouldn't have to fight as to who pays the bill.
Yeah.
And we had social workers spending hours and hours writing to each other and arguing with each other from HSE to TUSLA, instead of saying, well, this is Molly's money and it's going to be paid from the same Department of Finance. Can we not just allocate it as a way of doing it that way? And then and we can preempt this, and we can do it in a multi-annual budget. Because if Molly was ever to sue the state, they would be able to calculate an amount of money that was owed, 6 million, 5 million, whatever it might be. So can we not just preempt that and say, right, it's going to cost 100,000 every year for the next 10 years to look after Molly properly? Sometimes you won't reach that figure, and sometimes you will. So we're trying to get to that situation where these agencies can allow the child to be at the center of the decision making, rather than spending hours fighting over who pays the bill. And at the end of the day, it's the same tax dollar.
It's a circular transaction.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think those sort of things we can start to make a difference with.
And do you think, when you look, like, as you've come into this role, do you see, like, Ireland, how we look at children, and on kind of on the one hand, we see, you know, as you say, for a lot of children, it's a great country.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of children also who are left behind. You know, the figures are there, 1 in 10 children in poverty. And it's not just poverty and deprivation. It's, as you say, particularly children with disabilities, that we don't really have a rights-based society that we talk a lot about in here. That, and, you know, you're a human rights institution.
Mm-hmm.
And you talk about, do you think the core, a core issue would be if somehow we could shift to getting, like, state agencies to have to fulfill the rights of the child?
I think that's a huge step forward. I think that's where we need to be moving towards. I think it's time for us to start looking as a society as to what do we consider the legacy we leave behind, you know, especially my age now. I'm in my 50s. So I wanted to look and say, what has my generation improved on?
Yeah.
What are we sure that we're proud that we've left behind? And, you know, we have come out of, the most deepest recession, the most horrific, scary recession. And we're now at a situation where I think we're the fourth or fifth richest country in Europe. We're just on the fringes of full employment. So this is as good as it gets. And we still have 10% of our children living in poverty. We still have people with scoliosis, you know, who, if they got an operation within 4 months of the need being identified, they get up and run around and be flying. But if you leave it for 12 months, they may be affected for the next 3, 4, 5 years. You know, we're making false economies on a lot of the money based on our systems and the way we've set things up. Our housing, obviously, we'll come on to the housing. But we've got to see children at the center of our decision making. If we do that, we will also create much more energy, much more vitality, and a much more just society, which will in turn allow everything to blossom. President Higgins talks about us moving to a situation where our children are seen as future employees as opposed to children. You know, and we're gearing up. We talk about the STEMs, and we talk about education, and we talk about having the best educated employment pool in the world. And we're proud of that. But there's more to a childhood than that.
Exactly.
You know, and I think that's where we need to start with. What are the rights we want to give our child from the very start? And I think we are moving in that direction, but we've such a catch up to do from the way we saw children. I mean, I'm still young enough to remember to corporal punishment in schools. I remember situations where, you know, and I tell this to many children when I go out to schools, in second year, there was a thing called group cert, which you used to do before the junior cert. In my school, when we did the group cert, 1/3 of my class never came back.
Yeah.
They went off to do apprenticeships. They went off to do work in bars. They went to be mechanics, bodybuilding for cars, fishermen, farmers. They were all under 15 years of age when they left school. We've changed enormously. So we've come and made a lot of big strides in that regard, but we've done it in bits and pieces. And we need to start thinking about now, what are the sort of basic standards we're going to allow for every single one of our children so that nobody is left behind? The sort of Finnish, Scandinavian type thinking. It will cost us more money as individuals. We'll have to pay a little bit more tax. We'll have to think about things differently. But we will create a society and a world that Ireland can only dream of now. I mean, we talk about a world of 1,000 welcomes. This would be really putting it out there every day of the week.
There are lots that would argue, including Bernardo's and other agencies that would argue that for, you know, every euro you put into these things, they pay out in economic sense 4 to 5 times more down the line. Yeah. So, you know, I'm always very conscious of making that economic argument, because there's a lot of people who shout, where are you going to get the money for that? And you go, well, it's self-sustaining. Once you put the investment in, you will reap the rewards.
Yeah.
We just simply have to use that awful phrase, take the pain for a couple of years while we get things right.
Yeah, it's that early intervention. I mean, nobody argues against early intervention, but even simple things like child-friendly budgets, knowing how much we spend on children. Even the Department of Education can't tell us how much they spend on children. You know, I've asked the Department of Health how much you spend on mental health for children, and they can't tell us. They'll tell us mental health budget is 1 billion, which is only 1/17 of the total health budget. So that's a small percentage for start with. The best guesstimate we can come up with is that only 20% is spent on children. But yet we know 75% of all adults who have mental health problems start in childhood. So again, we can start thinking about realigning. It wouldn't even change the budget. Even if you realign and say, right, okay, well, probably you need to invest more in the childhood side of things. We need to get more different types of early interventions that aren't necessarily as expensive. Some of our systems are built around psychiatrists and psychologists who are very expensive to bring in place. Maybe we use other types of therapists. Maybe we use it in different ways. So there's there's vested interest in need to think about how we can change things as well. But if you put children's rights into your legislation, they have no choice. And that's the piece we need to move towards.
Yeah. And it strikes me, you know, as parents, you know, you see your children as they grow up and you see like how everything around them, you know, their school, their environment, their housing, you know, the stress in your family, how it impacts on them.
Mm-hmm.
And that, mm-hmm. and you see as well, like the gaps in terms of like accessing the health service and the delays. And it makes me so angry that, you know, recently I had an issue with my daughter, you know, and she broke her arm and we went to the hospital and you see the big sign for, you know, private patients over here. And, you know, as a public patient, you get a good service, but you can see, you can be told, well, you can get that scan done probably quicker if you can go private. Mm. And then if there's a more serious issue, well, you need that done, you can get it privately. And you see that actually, you know, poverty captures one thing,
mm-hmm.
but we still have deep inequalities that affect people and so many affect children. And how, and you just start to think about how each child at each moment where we don't ensure equality and every child having a right, that they are disadvantaged.
Yeah.
And the destruction of that child's childhood, you know, and what it will mean for them as an adult, that it really is, we still don't have a child-centered country.
No. I think you're right. I mean, I've often used the phrase that I think the haves are sailing away from the have-nots now,
mm.
in a way that it hasn't happened before. I don't know the actual figures, but I believe that the gap between the minimum wage and the highest wages is much wider.
Well,
than
we saw it. You saw it yesterday's in the CSO reports. It was geographical. You could see where, you know, depending on where you live, mm-hmm. your this is what your salary is going to be, and you could actually see then the glaring thing where 14% of people were earning over 100,000, and yet 26% of people were, or the majority of the income to that household was a form of social transfer. That tells you in economic terms that there's a huge glaring gap. 14%, as you say, the haves are sailing away, and that 26% figure is a growing figure. It's up on the last time the CSO produced a report, I think by about 8%. I could be wrong, but that's all I can recall at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
Which I suppose does bring us to housing.
Yeah, and you produced a fantastic report on the family hubs.
Mm-hmm.
and homelessness, and you presented just to the Oireachtas as well, mm-hmm. very recently, mm-hmm. in terms of that. Maybe you could outline kind of the main findings of that research. And
yeah, I mean, the report's called No Place Like Home. And I suppose what we did, and it's part of my mandate is to make sure that I hear the voices of children that are seldom heard.
Mm-hmm.
Homelessness has been on my strategic policy or plan for the last 3 years, and it's going to stay on it for the next 3 years as well. But part of that, one of the things we can do is go in and talk to the children and young people in those situations. We felt it wasn't viable to go in and talk to people in hotels and B&Bs because they weren't guaranteed to be in the same place all the time. So we went into the family hubs and we chatted to the young people there. We went to Dublin, Cork and Limerick to make sure there was a spread. We talked to children in private hubs and in NGO run hubs as well. We chatted to children from 5 years of age up to 18, and we also chatted to the parents of children who were under five. And consistently, they were all very, very happy with the staffing and the way they were treated in the hubs. And they felt a lot of them felt it was very positive in comparison to where they might have been. They might have been in overcrowded family situations. They might have been mm-hmm. intense family situations. They might have been in hotels or B&Bs privately. But a lot of the younger children who wouldn't have known to be able to compare those two things just felt it wasn't a good place to be. A lot of them were able to say there's nothing positive about this because they had no friends who could come over. They weren't allowed to have their family over at times, you know, because they can't have other people into the family hub situation mm-hmm. for child protection issues. A lot of them, depending on where they were, some of them didn't have any play areas. The older children had no privacy in their, none of them had privacy in their bedroom, but not the older children who wanted to go and do their homework outside of the bedroom were still going to do it in the middle of a public TV room or a room that everybody else used. There was a great example of a young teenage girl who was been driven demented by her 7-year-old sister in the bedroom and said, I'm going to go down to the open room to do that. But in order for her to go down to the open room, her mother and the 7-year-old sister had to come down with her to walk her down and stay with her. So what happened then? She got even more embarrassed because the 7-year-old sister was acting up down there and disturbing everybody else. So she ended up back in the bedroom. And these are small things in the run of the mill day to day. But if you do that for 6 months and you're trying to do a leaving cert or a junior cert, it's going to impact you constantly. The parents were consistently saying that, you know, this is not an appropriate place for us to family, to be a family. It's not an appropriate place for us to parent. Children were hearing things, you know, just noise. Raised voices, arguments, fights, possibly violence occasionally. There was alcohol at times, drunkenness, you know, things that children and families shouldn't have to engage with, through no fault of their own. Again, the majority of the people, we didn't get into too deeply, but all the reports have shown the majority of people in family hubs are now economic, are there for economic reasons.
Yeah. They left the private rental
center. Simply because they've been evicted because they can't afford the rent. A lot of them are working. There's a story in there too of, a man and his wife and two kids are in the family hub. He's out building houses, social houses, that then are going to go to somebody in homelessness. And the workmates around him who don't know he's homeless are slagging off these homeless who are going to get these good houses. And he has to bite his tongue and say, you know, because he's embarrassed about where he's found himself and his family, and he feels he's failed his family. And it's a huge, so there's huge impact here. And, you know, and as a psychologist, we now know the first 1,000 days of a child's life are really, really important in how their brain develops and the way they feel safe and secure and confident about themselves. And if they're picking up on the tension of their parents and of the situations they're in, and it's going to impact them over time. So we're certainly storing up a lot of problems for ourselves into the future. And one of my concerns is that if we give everybody a house today, all the homeless are housed today, we haven't changed the system sufficiently that this won't happen again in the next bust. Because there will be an next bus, it's guaranteed. But we haven't changed the way that there should be alternative rental systems. There should be safe, secure rental systems at a certain level. Landlords should be allowed to take money over 20 years, 30 years, so they can make it relatively okay profit at maybe inflation level. We haven't made it secure. Like every other country in the world, you could live your life in rental accommodation and know you can stay in that same area. We haven't got to that because it seems to be the landlord and the private people are the ones who get the priority, as opposed to our citizens who really should see the housing as a social good, not a commodity. So we have a lot of work to do in that regard.
And in terms of that, the impact, because I think particularly it'd be important, like your expertise, you know, as a, you know, a psychologist that, you know, meeting these children, like what sort of impacts, you know, could you see in terms of their well-being and how that's likely to impact?
Well, I mean, simple stuff. If you're a child of, you know, there's the physical development, which we've heard about from other reports as well, that, you know, if you're in a hotel room and you're trying to crawl, but there's no space to crawl, that makes it harder for you to crawl. So you won't bother crawling. You just sit for longer.
Yeah.
So physical development. Then if you do decide to crawl, the only other option you have maybe is going to the toilet. So you've got less ability to build your physical developments and meet your milestones. But on an emotional level, many of the parents talked about their children not letting go of them because they've been taught not to let go of them. Yeah. You know, literally the parents aren't allowed to leave anywhere if the children are there. Children are not allowed to be on their own. So again, one of the independent things that you get as you grow up, as you're 10, 11, 12 years old, you can be left for 10 minutes with your brother and sister.
Yeah.
When the mother goes to the toilet, goes out, whatever it might be, that's not allowed. So everybody's in everybody's pocket. So the young child who's 1 or 2 years of age is becoming emotionally over-attached to the parent, which means they won't separate, they won't become independent, they'll have no confidence in themselves, self-esteem will be down. And if you add to that then later on, if they stay in it for too long, school and stuff like that, they'll start to be challenged and bullied and, you know, they'll be called different. All those sort of things can be stored up. And again, you know, the essence of a parent who's tense and feels like they failed means that they're not at their best for parenting either. So there's other knock-on effects. You know, if you feel that you're under pressure all the time, we don't know where we're ever going to get out of here. We had parents who had got into a family hub and got out through the HAP scheme.
Yeah.
And then ended up being kicked out again of that HAP scheme and coming back to family hub. So can you imagine how that parent felt about themselves and how scared they were of the future? And that's going to transmit down the line to the children. So we can't be sure what we're going to come up against, but it cannot be positive. There's going to be some resilient children who are going to do fine and they're going to move on and they're going to really be strong. But we've got to be careful. And I think it's one of the recommendations from our report is that we needed more child support workers and therapeutic support needs to be available to children who go in there because by its very nature, it's traumatic to be homeless. And we need to acknowledge that from the start.
And I think it's fair to say, especially we should talk in terms of the, it's not just family homes, it's not family hubs, it's not just hotels and B&Bs, even though I've witnessed a father bringing a buggy for an infant that was born into a hotel with holding his son's hand. And, you know, anyway, the devastation of that aside, we also have to talk about direct provision. We have to also talk about traveller accommodation. The children in those situations are in, if we want, we don't want to grade the misery. I'm sorry to be so blunt about it, but it's important that we look at those aspects as well.
Yeah, and again, that's the essence of if we can get to a situation where the right to housing is a constitutional one and is one that's legislated for, it allows us to say this is the floor below which no one will fall. We will not allow any child to live in this situation. You know, you can put a timeline on it. It might be 5 weeks, 6 weeks, whatever it might be. But we acknowledge that we need to provide housing for all of our citizens, not for the good of the landlords who can make a profit out of it, but for the good of our citizens into the infinitum, into the future. And that's where we need to go. And that's across all of those regimes. You know, again, obviously traveler accommodation is hugely problematic and controversial for some reason. It's the only one that I can think of, the only budget I can think of where nobody bats an eyelid when they send back 50% of the budget. If you were in any local council here around the world, around the country, and said, we haven't spent our budget for potholes, there'd be a riot. But yet you can send back the accommodation for travel. And again, if we see every child and every citizen being entitled to a home, it wouldn't matter about the traveler. It wouldn't matter. There wouldn't be different traveler accommodation budgets. There would just be accommodation budgets. And we need to get to that stage. Again, that's one of the things that I would like to see us saying as a society, we're acknowledging that nobody should be left in these situations. And it's becoming more and more important that we say that, and we say it loudly, because as I say, the haves are moving away and they're starting to not meet or understand or see what's happening with the have-nots.
And do you think in terms of that constitutional right to housing and putting it in the constitution, do you think that's what we need to do?
I think that's the ultimate acknowledgement of the right of the child and the right of all of our citizens. That's where it needs to be. Certainly, we can start quicker by doing it in legislation and we can do it through policy.
Yeah.
And I don't mind either of those. But I think what we do, we're doing it in a way that we can't reverse. And that's where I'm afraid that if you do legislation or you do it through policy, the next government can change that anytime they want.
Yeah.
But I think in constitution, you cannot do that without the citizens saying it's okay for us to change. And that's why I think our citizens are sick to death of being told that the landlord and the right to property is the bar to everything.
Yeah.
I think we need to look at that and challenge that and say, right, give the citizens an opportunity to say the right to housing. And it won't be a silver bullet. It won't clear everything all right. It'll take 10, 15 years to get there. I have no doubt about that. But we are leaving a message that says, us as a society, that's what we want to happen. And I think we've got to start doing that, because I'm afraid we will find a way to house all these people immediately. And the crisis will pass and we will have changed nothing for the future. And our children will face the same thing for their children down the line, because we haven't changed our system. And I think this will be a real legacy thing to say, this will not happen again.
And have you raised this with government, state?
Yeah, I mean, it was a recommendation within our report. We've presented that report to both Oireachtas Committee on Housing. And this week I presented as well to the Oireachtas Committee on Children and Youth Affairs, who are doing a report on homelessness as well. Again, you can see there are political decisions. People are asking, well, do we really need that? You know, they won't build a single house. I said, no, it won't build a single house, but it'll force you to start thinking that you have to start building these houses. You cannot leave people in homelessness for longer. So I think we have to make sure we don't lose the long term for fear, for pushing for the immediate. The immediate is crucial and we have to get that fixed. But we also keep thinking that this crisis is our opportunity to change ourselves for the future.
So have you thought through the practical steps of getting there in terms of a referendum?
I mean, it's again, I'm not going to get involved in what the wording should be. I think that's for the Oireachtas to do. But I think the practical steps are already in place. We've had the 8th Citizens Convention back in 2014 made a recommendation that the Oireachtas needs to look at the right to housing. That was in the program for government in 2016. They agreed to look at that. They've moved it from one Oireachtas committee to another. And so we've recommended that they need to bring that out and have a proper discussion about it. And then that should lead to whatever wording they want to get, cross-party wording. But I think it's showing a political will to do that. I think so. The practical steps, from my point of view, is start discussing those recommendations that have come from the citizens and make it happen and allow us the opportunity. And maybe the referendum will fall. I don't know. But at least the opportunity is there for the country as a whole to talk about housing and to make a decision about their own constitution.
And just on the family hubs, do you think, like, we talked about the family hubs and the situation in which we know, and, you know, I've done research on this and presented reports to the Oireachtas in 2017. You know, you've done reports, other people have presented. We know this is happening. And I referred, Una Mullally did an article in the Irish Times where she talked about the Magdalen laundries and, you know, they were hiding in plain sight.
Yeah.
The hubs, family hubs in particular, because hotels, to a certain extent, are a little different in that they're a temporary thing. Hubs are being built by the state to house people on a temporary basis as a solution to their housing issue. So it's a state act. It's a state response. It's a state policy that these are hiding in plain sight, that they are a breach of the children's rights in terms of the Children's Act, that, that these are actually, in a way, they are our current Magdalen laundries in a sense, but they're a scandal, like, in a deprivation that we know is happening. And therefore, how can the government, or not just the government, but the state, stand over this?
I suppose Mike Allen from Focus would talk about the tyranny of better than. You know, it's a better than option than the hotels and B&Bs, which are a bit more transient. It's better than living in an overcrowded space with a family who are at each other's throats. It's better than living in a tent. However, we need to set ourselves a higher standard than that. We need to move them on. So I think, again, from my point of view, I need to acknowledge that for now it should be a step, but it should be time limited, and we should say, right, the idea was that you should be in there and out in 3 months. But at the moment, the problem is the only out is through the HAP scheme, and there aren't enough landlords to take the HAP scheme all around the country. Galway hasn't got a rental accommodation. Limerick hasn't got rental accommodation. So HAP has no option, isn't really an option. So essentially you're putting people in there saying you're going to be out in 3 months, and their hearts are breaking after 6 months and the hope is gone. So it's a really difficult situation for now. But again, we've got to create a system that says we won't accept this. We're going to build, we're going to produce homes that you can use. We can produce a different type of accommodation that you can call your own. It's going to have own door, whatever way we need to move on that. But we are in that crux situation where it's better than, I can't accept it for children as an appropriate place to be, but I also can't accept them being on the street. So we have to find that balance, that we get those houses that they can move to as quickly as possible. And that's why I think the system has to change. HAP can't be the only option.
But when you think of models like, say, Housing First, for example, in Finland, there are those intermediary phases, but they do have that. You will have your own front door within sort of 3 months, I think, is their window. So yes, absolutely. There has to be a, I hate to say, a conveyor belt almost stage, that brings but at the same time, when we talk about housing, because the state talk in terms of housing solutions and housing solutions delivered, they don't talk in numbers of build anymore, and then as you said, HAP is considered social housing now. HAP is very definitely considered
housing. Yeah, within policy, it's described.
And because it's described as such, they can say, well, we've delivered more social housing solutions than ever in the history of the state. But
they're all in the private rental sector.
And you made the point already, Niall, that we don't have proper security of tenure, and you can't rent forever. You're 6 months away from starting your countdown to when you're homeless again. Yeah. So it's a washing machine. Yeah. You're just rolling around.
But also economically, as we've made the point, it's insane. They're going to be spending close to $1 billion a year on various subsidies to the private landlords.
Did 900 million last year.
In terms of total leasing. Yeah. And yet that $1 billion could be building permanent homes. And, you know, we've made the argument here in terms of cost rental, for example, that you would set up a public housing company to build rental for a range of incomes.
Yeah.
Because the problem is that currently, you know, the supply that they're relying on the private market for, we've already seen it slowing down.
Yeah.
That unless the state guarantees a delivery supply itself of building houses for low and middle income people, this crisis will continue.
Yeah. And I mean, it's what they're really, really proud of what they're doing now with the corporate entities coming involved in the rental and all the new building that's coming on board. I mean, when we see that Wilson Kennedy are saying that they're getting more rent out of Dublin than they are getting out of Los Angeles, you know, that's never going to be for the social good. You know, 1,900 euros a month is their average in Dublin, is 1,700 in Los Angeles. the stuff that's coming on stream is student accommodation and buy to rent, which are both allowed to be different sizes of accommodation, which don't provide family support, don't provide enough space for a family to grow in, don't provide parks and facilities and crèches. So they've been built for money, to make money. So the future is not as rosy as the numbers alone will tell you, but what new units are coming on board. There's no mention of family size housing, no mention of family size apartments with proper accommodation, which will create a new European norm. That's not there. And if I go back to the 1960s, my dad was involved in a small town in Donegal of a population of about 1,000 people putting together a National Building Association estate. We built in co-op. 40 houses built among themselves, funded by the government. Just got together and did that. And we could do that in the 60s. And that was constantly part of the thing up until the 1980s, before the NBA was put away. There's ways of doing it, and people locally will do things if you give them the opportunity and we give them the land and allow them to do it. So I think we're getting carried away by the profit margin, and we're getting carried away by the numbers that are coming in and saying it's good to have corporate entities. However, we've got to be careful that they provide for families, not just the student and the well-paid professional who's a single person. You know, the whole idea is that we create for the whole of society, and those options have to be there, because there's no point building 20,000 units if they only house individuals who are married or in couples.
Co-living.
I mean, the co-living is, you know, such a short-term option, and no problem having it once in a while, but it can't be the answer. There's no way that's going to be the answer.
Well, planning permissions are actually down year on year by 3.5%, folks. So whatever way you address it, it is. There are constraints in the market. The market has hit peak for-profit delivery, you know, and I mean for-profit is in terms of the people that keep saying, well, supply is meets demand. That's never happened in the history of state. Stop arguing it. It doesn't work. But what does work is if you can't afford to buy the bloody thing, it's going to sit there. And now we're seeing builders sitting there saying, well, I can't build it for less than 330,000. I need to make my 20%, 10%, whatever. Therefore, it's not viable. Yet, as you said, cooperatives like O'Coolan, 2 kilometres up the road, can build for 220,000. You can't scale that up.
Do you think that, you know, broadening it a bit, that the idea of, and it's interesting, cooperatives, because, and, you know, housing, and we can think broader in terms of how we structure economy. And like, we think the minister will get up at its budget in October and say, you know, these are the key indicators. Like, where will be, you know, in a way you should think the starting point should be our key indicator is the well-being of our children. And how do we measure that?
Yeah. And again, I think that's a huge piece. If we also say, you know, we're saying 10% of our children living in poverty, if some percentage of those children had a house provided to them, a home provided to them, then you're going to change a lot of indicators, not just about housing and homelessness. You're going to change well-being. You're going to change employment opportunities. You're going to change addresses. You're going to change health outcomes as well. You know, because you will be in control of the estate and you'll know how to run it and you'll know what's happening and you'll get the guards. There could be all sorts of very massive positives that come in all elements of society if he was to build up a proper stock and create a situation where the government are the builders and are the owners, as we have been for many years. So again, that would be a real step forward, as opposed to the number of units which have been built by private people that we will possibly lease for a period of time, or probably give people money to rent for a period of time. And we have no asset. You know, we don't own it. We don't have control over it. So when those big corporates go after 10 years and it's bought by another guy who wants to make a killing out of it, who will not bother reinvesting in it, those things will become less attractive and will lead to all sorts of difficulties as well. And because the facilities aren't there. And again, we're in a situation in Dublin where we've seen this in the 60s and 70s. If you don't build the houses without the facilities, we're going nowhere.
Yeah.
You know, we know what's going to happen there. It's guaranteed that you're not going to have the best society out of it.
Yeah.
So when we do that and we say, that's okay because you're a professional and you don't need a kitchen, you know, what are we saying to the people who buy it after? You know, where are we going with all those people? Are they going to be here forever more? We've got to start seeing, what does our society look like? And it's got to be a mix. There's no problem having those there, but the mix has got to be, and the mix I'm missing is the family. I don't hear anything about children and family in any of these buildings, because you can build student accommodation, you can build buy to rent much quicker and with much better profit and with much less add-ons to it. And that's where we're going. And those units are being counted as an addition to our facilities. And they're not for our families.
And in terms, just to move on, the area of climate change, we talk a lot about, has that come up, or is that something that, because obviously children have been leading in terms of, you know, what, in terms of the climate strikes, mm-hmm. in terms of, you know, what type of, you know, planet we have and how we're changing. Does that come up, or have children raised that with you?
They have. They raise it with us. I mean, there's a number of consistent issues with us. I mean, the one that would normally come up to us when we ask children, we get 1,000 children a year through our office, they'll always bring up homelessness and mental health. And then they bring up climate change. So they're the top three.
Yeah.
And within those, you might also have bullying and stuff within the mental health side of things. But so the children have been aware of this for years, and they've been really consistent about it. And they know there's been phenomenal work on green flags and stuff in every single school.
Yeah.
And pester power when they go home to the mother and father and say, right, you've got to do this right and follow through. So they've really been at the cutting edge of it. I think we're now getting to the national stage, and I think it's hugely important because again, my own children have an actual anxiety about it. Yeah. What's our future going to look like?
Yeah.
You know, and they're really worried about that. And they can see not only that they may not be able to buy a house, they may not have a planet to work on. They may not have, you know, so everything is about recognizing their future over the next 50 years. And they see it, and they see the ones that are going to have to pay the cost. So I think it has been important for them. And I think we're really getting to the stage where, again, we're listening to children, and they're not asking for too much. They're just asking for enough. Please do the right thing here. No.
It's interesting that they raise, like you're saying, the key issues children are raising are homelessness, mental health, climate, mm-hmm. and bullying.
Mm-hmm.
It would be incredible if we actually turned and said, well, do you know what? There are four priorities as a country. How do we change our country to make sure, you know, people aren't affected by these? And you could imagine we would have a much better country.
Yeah. And again, I mean, if you want to just make it economics, can you imagine fixing those three things?
Yeah.
Imagine fixing homelessness and fixing mental health. The economy would blossom.
Yeah, and climate.
You know, and climate follow through. So I mean, there's all sorts of things that where you take your priorities from is crucial, and it says what you are as a society. You know, we see the political ship is turning towards climate change now because they've been forced to think that way by our children, and by our children pestering our parents who voted in a certain way. You know, but if you listen to the children right from the start, you might move in a whole different direction quicker.
Do you think children are becoming more anxious? Because you mentioned anxiety there about climate, right? And in terms of them and thinking about the future and the world, Ian, are they? Or
I would think there is. I think we're in a different world.
Social media and everything.
I think we're in a different world now where children are much more aware of a lot more things than we ever would have been. I mean, again, I lived a simple life where I wanted to get the nearest football and a couple of guys to kick around with and play any sort of sport. And that was it. And I knew about Donegal, and I knew about a little bit more. And, you know, I mean, whatever was on that one or two stations that we had, that was where we got our understanding of the world from. They know about Tehran. They know about Bush. They know about the fear of war. They know about North Korea. All these things are there. And when you're young and unsure of yourself, you need certainty in the world. And I think our world is so uncertain now. And we constantly talk about that uncertainty. I mean, Brexit's 3 years. That's constant anxiety for all of us. I mean, from the Taoiseach down, we're all anxious about Brexit. And there's nobody going to be unaffected by it. So I think there is an anxiety, and you've got pressures of exams. You've got fear that you won't be able to get into college, fear that you won't be able to get a job, fear that you won't get housing now. As you get older, those things become more and more important to you, and you're more aware of what's not available than we probably ever were. I mean, I knew that if I didn't go to college, I would get a job in a bar, I'd get a job somewhere around home. There'd always be a bit of work to be done. Once you were willing to work, there was always work. It wasn't big pay. You weren't going to make a killing on it, but you would never be unemployed. Nowadays, it seems more and more likely that unless you get university, you're less work to do. And, you know, those people that I talked about leaving, apprenticeships are only starting to come back again now. You know, so if you're not in that range of people who want to go to college, there's a lot less opportunities than there were for you. So again, there's another anxiety for you. What are you going to do? And one of the recommendations I've made about education to the future is to consider us, instead of in a 5-day week, if we bring down the university or the leaving cert to 5 subjects and do them over 4 days, and then use your 5th day to do the thing you love. And get credit for that, whether that's hairdressing, landscape gardening, mechanic, painting, decorating, looking after old folks. and you get credit for that as well, then you created a more rounded and more sustainable, resilient young person.
Yeah.
And instead of just thinking points are everything, you're saying points plus a rounded individual and a community aware individual could create a different type of education. You know, so I think the anxiety is definitely there for a lot of people. And again, it's something we just need to help them to deal with. And I think they are also some of the most fantastic young people now. They're some of the brightest, articulate, engaged, socially aware, positive, active young people, young generation. You know, I think we have a really bright future with these people. And I'm so lucky to be involved.
It's a pity that some of them aren't getting into leadership sooner or later. Yeah. But just in terms of finish up then, what do you kind of see as your key kind of goals over the next, what, you have 3 years left or potentially longer? Or
it's, well, I've a 6 year term, so 2021 would be the end of the first term if there's an opportunity, if people are happy with me to keep going for another term. But I suppose in general for my office,
the rules and make it a position for life.
Absolutely not. I don't think the whole essence of the reason you got a 6 year term is that you give it everything you can. Yeah. You're not expecting to get a full time job out of it and you move through it and you become a pain in the side and you do that and move on. I think that's an important part of it. So, but from my point of view, I suppose those two things that I started with, if we can create a child centered administration and public administration where they ask every time they ask themselves, what's in the best interest of this child, not this system? And if the system and the child clash, can we look to more to change the system rather than the child? You know, so that should create less exclusion, you know, less exceptions. I think that'll be a huge step forward. And individually then we are, you know, we're working on those priorities that we spoke about. In the strategic plan, we're looking at children with mental health issues, homelessness, disability, direct provision and traveler enrollment, you know. So if we can make progress on those over the next 3 years, I'd be very, very happy. And I think a lot of them are tied together. You know, as I said, if you get homelessness fixed and traveler accommodation, we can probably fix at the same time. If you get traveler accommodation fixed, you may get their education better. You may get longer stays in education. All those sorts of things will knock on. But I think individually, from my point of view, I think if we can get more and more secretary generals, more and more high-level civil servants being willing to look at the best interest of the child and trusting their individual, the staff below them, to think that's a decision well made based on the best interest of that child. It may mean we have to adjust the funding. It may mean we have to adjust how we get the funding. It may mean something else, but we're going to work on it. And I think that's a real step forward.
Great. Niall, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you very much,
Niall. And just in terms of, if you like these podcasts, if you're enjoying doing it, listening, please chip in. We need the support, financial support, to keep going, keep the show on the road. So please go on to Patreon and support us.
Thanks for listening, Niall. I appreciate your time. Thanks for coming. This, and I share exactly what Rory says. We're only ever 1 month away from having this thing blow up in our faces. But if you give us the price of a cup of coffee, do. Thanks very much. Take care. Bye-bye.